So John,
who's still alive and kicking down in Australia. But this was sort of, and I quoted this in two of my books, was his, how strong he was, because he said to me, okay, your despair and empowerment work, very powerful, I think it is, but I want, can you not move it more clearly to voice against anthropocentrism? When humans investigate and see through their layers of anthropocentric self-cherishing, a most profound change in consciousness begins to take place. Alienation subsides. The human is no longer a stranger apart. Your humanness is then recognized as merely the most recent stage of your existence. And as you stop identifying exclusively with this recent chapter, you start to get in touch with yourself as mammal, as vertebrate, as a species only recently emerged from the rainforest. As the fog of amnesia disperses, there is a transformation in your relationship to other species and in your commitment to them. I am protecting, then the rainforest develops to, I am part of the rainforest protecting myself. I am that part of the rainforest recently emerged into thinking. What a relief, then. The thousands of years of imagined separation are over, and we begin to recall our true nature. The change is a spiritual one, sometimes referred to as deep ecology. Now, deep ecology, as you probably know, is a term coined by a Norwegian philosopher, Arne Næss. He's a scholar of Gandhi and a fearless mountain climber. And he coined this term to contrast it with what he called shallow environmentalism that would clean up this river or that swamp for the benefit of the humans only, or the pleasure of humans. And he sees, and he coined a term that we've been using a lot in my thinking and my work, which is the ecological self. And he said that with sufficient all-sided maturity, we not only move on from ego to social self, to metaphysical self, but an ecological self as well. Through widening circles of identification, we vastly extend the boundaries of our self-interest and enhance our joy and meaning in life. So you can see why I grokked that, having earlier been a student of Rilke's in the Book of Hours, in that second poem of his in the Book of Hours that I cited, I think Friday night, tells us, remember, I've been circling around God, I've been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon? Am I a storm? Am I a great song? You are more a great song than you are your current name and social security number and dress size. And so one of the things I like about this is that it saves us from moralizing about being altruistic and kind and considerate to other people and other life forms. When we assumed that we were essentially separate, we called on people to be altruistic, that is to favor the other, alter in Latin, more than the self, ego in Latin. But that is philosophically unsound from the perspective of deep ecology, and it's also ineffective. And this is a quote from him. Arnie Ness, his words. The extensive moralizing within the ecological movement gives the public the false impression that they are primarily asked to sacrifice, to show more responsibility, more concern, better morals. But the requisite care flows naturally if the self is widened and deepened so that the protection of free nature is felt and conceived of as protection of our very selves. It's obvious, isn't it? In every religion, as I've thought about it, there are different ways of seeing the world around us. And I've pulled out over the years four different ways. And in different religions, see these. This is possible, and that these four ways are present in different spiritual paths. And one is as battleground, seeing the world as a battlefield. Second is as a trap. The third is as lover. And the fourth as self. Now, lover and self I feel they're very closely related. Both are without fear and need for domination. But battlefield or trap are worth just noticing for a moment, because although battlefield goes way back to a Manichaean view of reality where the world is seen as a battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and that they are of right and wrong. And seeing the world this way summons up the blood. It's very good for courage and readiness to act. And it feels, you feel you're on God's side and you must win at any cost. And that's just the thing to do. And no pussyfooting around. And we can see today in Africa how good that can feel. And the world, what happens to the world? The world then recedes in importance, just a backdrop to your moral struggles and battles. Doesn't matter what happens to the world. And the other view of the world, which is also very ancient and also is as the world as a trap. It's a broken place, polluted in suffering. It's incomplete. And the spiritual journey then is seen as extracting yourself from the toils of the material world and ascending. The direction is usually up, ascending to a realm of perfection from imperfection, ascending to light from darkness, ascending to life from death. And that appeals to the human mind. And as it's been in the past, you can still hear that. But one of the things among the many things that I love about Carl Gustav Jung is he nailed that. And he said, when you move from the age of Pisces, which is this duality in the age of Pisces. He said the spiritual journey is seen as a journey to perfection. But in the age of Aquarius, the spiritual journey is a journey to wholeness. What a difference. Journey to perfection, you're climbing upwards, trying to get away from the mire and muck and pain of the world. And in a journey toward wholeness, what's the gesture? It's an embrace. It's a coming home, yes, holding together. With John Seed, oh, wait a minute, so I haven't finished. I feel that I should, so the world is lover is a view that I find most mainly in the East in terms of religious paths, particularly in devotional Hinduism. Vishnu is in his form, particularly as Krishna. You can sing in these bhajans, or you just feel, you ride devotional emotion, and especially even erotic emotion, to union. And that's his beautiful skin, like the color of the monsoon clouds that bring fertility, and the glint of his eyes like dew on a rose petals, and the honey of his lips, and you sing. What you're singing to him is a song also to the natural world. You have a little bit of that in Hildegard of Bingen, in the Rhineland mystics, in my root tradition of Christianity, and some bridal mysticism. But I find the most compelling vision of this, if you will permit me to tell it to you, in lay literature, secular literature, particularly in a book by the Italian storyteller Italo Calvino. Now, in this book of stories, it's called Cosmic Comics. Does anybody know Cosmic Comics? It's still in print, and it's not that old, but you have the whole story of the universe in it, and it's all recounted from the point of view of the same guy. He's there the whole way through, sort of like Mel Brooks in The 3,000-Year-Old Man. But this guy's name is, it's hard for you to hear, isn't it? Because there are no vowels to it. It's spelled Q-W-F-W-Q, so you try it. So Kufik is remembering the whole story of the universe and from his perspective. And each chapter is preceded by a caption drawn from a scientist. And so what I want to tell you is just a synopsis from the chapter called All in One Point. So the summer says, according to the computations of the astronomer Edwin P. Hubble, the rate of expansion of the galaxies is such that it can be computed when they all originated at one point, when all matter energy in the universe was concentrated in a single point. So, of course, Crick remembers this. And he says, boy, was it crowded. When you think of everything we know, Disneyland, the Pentagon, Lebanon Valley College, the Andromeda Nebula, the beryllium isotopes, Hollywood, whole thing in one point. Well, we can, because you were there. I was there, And you'd think that we were really packed in there like sardines, weren't we? But you know, even that sardines, a can of sardines is a spatial metaphor, and we had no space. You'd think that a situation like that, he said, would make for neighborliness. But it didn't. Because to be neighborly, you have to be able to back off a little bit. Just a little bit. And there they were. And on top of that, there was the Zazu family and all their kids and all their camping equipment. Remember that? All over the place. They never pick up after themselves. Their laundry strung from one point of point to the other side of the point. They were just, you know. So it was irritating, wasn't it, sometimes? And I don't know how we would have stood it without, oh, just the thought of her brings a generous notion and feeling to my whole being. You'll remember her. Her hips, her thighs, her orange dressing gown. Signora Pavaccini. So I've given her that name because in the story of Italo Calvino, her name is an equation. So I like to call her Signora Pavaccini. You'll remember her. Of course you do. And the fact that she was having an affair with Mr. You know, in one point, it doesn't matter, does it? Because when she would go to bed with Mr. then we were all in there with her. And it could have just gone on like that for a long, forever, couldn't it? Until one day, I guess that's when days began. She said to us, "Oh, darlings, what pasta I could make for you if I only had some space." And at that point, it happened. In that tiny enclosed world, she had that generous impulse. Oh, boys, if I only had some space, what pasta I could make for you. It happened, and we could see her hands, and we could see the rolling pin, and we could see her arms smeared with olive oil and dusted with flour, and we could see the hill of flour over her, and then we saw beyond it the fields of wheat that made the flour, and then we saw the hillsides with the tomato vines. Of course, you have to have salsa pomodoro with your pasta, and it was happening, and then we had to see a planet that would turn in the sun and have night and day for cool and vectors of change of temperature and draw clouds for the rain. We had to have that, and then you had to have a sun that the planet would move around, and then you had to have a galaxy that the planets were, solar system were moving in. And as she just said those words, it was all in those words. If I only had some space, what pasta I could make, and they whoop, and we were all cast out, forming a universe. And some of us all the way to Lebanon Valley College this morning. And then Italo Calvino, the storyteller, says, and in that, Signora Pavaccini, scattered into thousands of Signora Pavaccinis, is she lost to us forever. So I thank you for the permission to tell you some of my secrets of understanding deep ecology. You find your own. This is. And then you can know with this one that you can recognize. Oh, I see a little glint of Signora Pavaccini, and in you too, and in you, her generosity.